Got my Bible right here open in front of me, but I don't need it for what we're studying, and that always makes me feel a little awkward because we're actually studying the history of our ancestors spiritually. In school, we learned about Jefferson and Washington. We learned about the different battles for our independence and our freedom, and we should be thankful for the sacrifices that men made for us to have the freedom we have. And we need to remember that history. I'm afraid that it's being tarnished. Our younger generations are not getting the history lessons we got when we were in high school. And a lot of the things have been twisted and reinvented. But we should be thankful for our national history. We should also be thankful for our spiritual history. And by that I mean, as Bible-believing Baptists, we have a history. And we've been studying that for the past couple of months now, starting from the New Testament and going down through the Donatists and the Paulicians and the Waldensians and all these different groups, going over as they were chased across Europe and then fled the continent into England and Scotland. And then as they sailed to Holland, and from Holland, as you know, came over here to America, again, because of the persecution and looking for religious freedom, and they came and settled here in the United States. And man being man, at his best state is altogether vanity. When he broke away from the control that other people had over him, he desired to put that same control over somebody else. And so the very people that left Europe and left the island of England and came to America, when they got in control here, put the same kind of regulations and restrictions on other people. And in states like Massachusetts, which was the worst of them, they set up the Congregational Church and taxed every resident and every citizen, and they had to pay a tax to the church. They could not vote if they weren't on the membership roll of the church. They could not hold any kind of office. They could not be successful in practical life, opening up a store, a gunsmith shop. If they weren't members of the church, people didn't do business with them. And so there was the same kind of oppressive control they tried to get away from. All along this time, as we've been studying, there was a small group, a small remnant called Baptists that weren't part of that and fought against that and were oppressed mightily because of it, imprisoned, beaten. We saw Obadiah Holmes last week tied to a post in Boston and 39 lashes put on his back for preaching without a license. That was his great crime, 39 lashes. Something that happened to him that he suffered the rest of his life from, and right after it slept, as one person testified, on his elbows and his knees because he could not lay down on his back or flat on his chest from the wounds he received from that. And so our ancestors, spiritually speaking, have made sacrifices for us to have the freedom we have. That was, again, over preaching without a license. Much of it was against over infant baptism, as we've talked about so much. And today, in our day, we don't make much of the doctrines that our forefathers paid with their blood for. And so it's good for us to learn these things. One of the wise sayings is, the only thing men learn from history is that men never learn from history. And if we can learn from our ancestors, spiritually speaking, we're in good shape. We're continuing on in continental America as we look at these tonight. We'll look at five names and try to get through these very quickly. Let me recommend two books. When you're reading these things, if it piques an interest or it's something you like, you can always type these names in on Google and get information about most of them. Now, sometimes they're hard to find Samuel Harris. That's such a common name that it's kind of hard to find the right Samuel Harris sometimes. And then Wikipedia is not a good source for accurate information. Those of you that are familiar with the computer and Wikipedia, anybody can contribute to that site and put things on there, and they're not necessarily verified, so that's not good. But let me give you two sources for good information. They're books, and they're about that thick. But one of those is America in Crimson Red by James Beller. If you want to read about this period in American history and read about the sufferings of the Anabaptists, the Baptist movement, the separatists, that's a good book, America in Crimson Red by James Beller. And also What Hath God Wrought by Bill Grady. And again, both of these books, America in Crimson Red's about that thick. What Hath God Wrought's about that thick. So they're not short reads. I think What If God Writes, probably about 700 pages, something like that. But if you like this kind of history, religious history, and it's not just religious, it's the founding of our country. And when you read about some of these fellows, like the first one we're going to look at and learn about that, you understand why our nation is the way it is and where we came from when we read these things. So let's talk about some of these. Last week when we looked at the first set of names, we looked at people that were actually born in England and then came over here and became Baptists once they got here. The ones we're going to look at now are those that were actually born here in the States as we move forward in time. These are those that were born in America, not in England, that came over. The first one is a name, he's one of my favorites with every one of these guys. So I'll just start with this one. He's one of my favorites. His name is Shubal Stearns. Shubal Stearns was born in Boston on January 28th of 1706 and was converted when George Whitefield was here in the United States in the Great Awakening. It wasn't at one of his services, but it was through his preaching that Shubal Stearns was converted when Whitefield preached in Connecticut. At that time, Shubal Stearns became a preacher, and by all accounts, he was much like George Whitefield. George Whitefield was a Methodist preacher, probably my favorite preacher as far as history goes. I've got a big two-volume book about him that's down in the library. But he was quite an orator, and they say that Shubal Stearns was an image of the guy I just said, I just lost his name, George Whitefield. All right, he was a great orator that way. He became a preacher in the branch of the Congregationalist Church called Separates. Within the Congregational Church, people got upset, and I know I'm going to get ahead of myself, because membership was open to anybody that wanted to join. Again, you had to be a member of the church to do anything, so everybody needed to join. And people would join regardless of their spiritual condition, regardless of the morality of their life. Now, if they were adulterers, if there's something like that, the church would not accept them. But drunkards didn't have a problem. Wicked people, basically, in their life didn't have a problem. The church would accept them. The Separates broke away from the Congregational Church, or a section of them, because they separated because of that. They were also called, you see in the page, New Lights, because they believed in conversion for church membership. What a novel idea, that before you could join the church, you had to be born again. And so they are still in the Congregational Church, but they had a separate designation for these. And so Shubal Stearns was part of the Congregational Church called the Separates. However, through reading the Scriptures, he was convinced of the truth of believers' baptism by immersion. Again, none of the other denominations back then were the Congregationalists, the Church of England, the Episcopalians, the Presbyterians, none of these were practicing baptism by immersion for adult converts. They were all baptizing infants and babies at 3, 4, 5 months old. So in his study of the Bible, he realized that no babies were ever baptized. And he realized that everybody that was baptized was old enough to make a conscious decision for themselves of what they were doing. And so through his study, he came to that truth by immersion. And in March of 1751... he, along with his wife, his parents, his sisters, and brothers, were immersed by a Baptist elder named Waite Palmer in Stonington, Kentucky, and he became a Baptist. So this is where a big Baptist movement started in the United States. We're going to see the effects of Shubal Stearns, and that's his roots, that's how it happened. In 1754, he felt led of the Lord to venture south from New England, and after a year in Virginia, settled in Sandy Creek, North Carolina. What happened is there was 8 people that left Connecticut to go to Virginia. It was Shubal Stearns and his wife, his brother and his wife, his sister-in-law, or his sister and brother-in-law, his mother and his father, his aunt and his uncle. They were all family members. And 8 of them moved to Virginia to start a church. And after 1 year in Virginia, he heard about the need of the peasant farmers, of the frontiersmen in North Carolina. And so after that 1 year there, he ventured from New England, and after a year in Virginia, settled in Sandy Creek, North Carolina. Now, Sandy Creek, I looked it up on the map, is down near Wilmington, North Carolina, down in the southeast part of it. That's where Sandy Creek is. But somebody listed the church as being actually... Sandy Creek is the creek that runs down through that part of North Carolina, and they're saying that the church is actually in Liberty, North Carolina, which is up towards Greensboro, up that way. But anyways, out in that area, this church is still in existence. Sandy Creek Baptist Church that he founded is still in existence even today. But they moved to Sandy Creek, North Carolina. A great revival took place, and the membership rose from 16, that was those eight couples, to 606 in 2 years. His preaching and the spirit of revival, again, the great awakening was taking place at that time, and people were being saved in the colonies by the dozens, saved by the scores. Wouldn't we love to see that happen again? Wouldn't we love to see the preaching of the word penetrate hearts where people just got on their knees and repented of their sins and got saved? That's what was going on back then. In 1758, Stern started the Sandy Creek Baptist Association. Because of his church and the strength of it and the 600 people, they began sending preachers out around North Carolina. And as you'll see, they even went into Georgia, South Carolina, and Virginia. And that association by 1772 had started 42 other churches in those states right around North Carolina. What a powerful moving of God took place through Shubal Stearns. He organized the churches. Now, I hate to give you the bad news. The Sandy Creek Baptist Association today is called the Southern Baptist Association, and it's nothing like the Sandy Creek Baptist Association was back in that day. But they were powerful, they were evangelistic, they majored in soul winning. They sent out 125 preachers were sent out by the church at Sandy Creek to start those 42 other churches all around North Carolina, Virginia, Georgia, and that area. 125 preachers were sent out by the church at Sandy Creek and its founded churches. Shubal Stearns died on November 20th, 1771, and is buried near the church at Sandy Creek. I'm just the kind of Baptist historian or interested in it. I'd love to travel to Sandy Creek just to see the grave of Shubal Stearns and see this part of history and how it's marked there. So here's a man that was filled with the Spirit of God, that had the power of God, that started not only a church, but 42 churches, 125 preachers going out, and affected that whole area of the country with the gospel of the Lord Jesus Christ. All right, while the other churches were dead, and membership was open to anybody, and they're baptizing babies that didn't know what they're doing, here's a guy that started a movement that was preaching the gospel and getting people converted and born again and going into heaven when they die. We can do the same thing today. While other churches are worried about their little things and stuff like that, we can preach the gospel, get folks saved. So that's Shubal Stearns. Number two, Isaac Backus. Isaac Backus. 1724 to 1806, born in Norwich, Connecticut on January 9th, 1724. Again, he was converted during the Great Awakening. All right, that great spiritual movement that went through the colonies back in the late 1700s. Under the preaching of George Whitefield in 1741, and joined the Congregational Church in his hometown. All right, that's what most of the colonies were, congregational. And they were just a formal church. There was no preaching of the gospel. And everybody that's just the church you went to, because that was the only church in town. In 1745, he started a separate church. We just talked about what separate is. Still congregationalist, but separated because they saw the unconverted church members. Separate due to disagreement over admission of unconverted church members. By 1749, infant baptism became a doctrine of interest among his church members. And in August of 1751, he was baptized by immersion. Here's a congregationalist preacher, a separatist preacher that realized from his study of the scriptures that baptism was by immersion. And so he submitted to that doctrine later in life, as an adult, realized his baptism didn't do him any good. It wasn't the right way. So he was baptized in 1751. On January 16th of 1756, the members of the church who had become Baptists formed themselves into a distinct church with Isaac Backus as their pastor, all right? They were congregationalists, separatists within it. Then they realized the true doctrines of baptism and converted church membership, so they pulled out and started their own church and made Isaac Backus their pastor. He served in this position until his death on November 20th of 1806. Now, that's enough to make Isaac Backus a noteworthy person in our history, but let's go farther. He had been the Baptist representative to the Continental Congress in 1774. When you hear the statement, separation of church and state, That doesn't go back to Thomas Jefferson in the 1800s and his letter to the Dansbury Baptist. It goes back to Isaac Backus. In one of his sermons, he preached about this, and that's why he was the Baptist representative from Massachusetts to go to the Continental Congress, because he was lobbying, he was pushing for a separation of church and state. Again, the Congregational Church was the power in the state. And if you weren't part of that church, you had no rights. You paid taxes to the congregational minister. You had no rights. You weren't licensed to preach. Everything you did was illegal. So he was the Baptist representative of the Continental Congress that pushed. And I'm trying to remember his words. He didn't say separation, but he said it was something about church and state and their cohesion or their sticking together, and that they needed to be separate in entity. And so he was the representative in 1774 and also published three volumes of Baptist history. Now again, if we're going to read history, you know what you need to do? You need to go back as far as you can to read the histories. If you want a history of America in 1776, don't read one that's written in 2018. Find one that was written in the 1800s. Before political persuasion change the minds of the writers of the books. Something happened before 1900 in America where the mentality changed, and we see the end result now that's complete godlessness and a rewriting of history. That's not new. That began over 100 years ago. So if you're going to read histories, his histories were all done in the 1800s. I think Baptist history number one, and I don't remember the dates, was written. Baptist history number two was like 13 years later. Baptist history number three was written 20 years later. He took a long time. He wrote those from all of his notes and his diaries and his stories. And so through Isaac Backus, we have a wonderful recorded history from 1800 of what happened in the 1700s. I got into a discussion with a fellow a few years ago about our ancestry. This was not the George Washington thing. I'll talk about later. But there were two different books about the same period of time in history, about this period of time, George Washington and all that kind of stuff. Two different books. One was published by Smithsonian Institute. The other was published by a Christian organization. Both of them talking about the same period of time. And if you read one, you wouldn't have thought the other one was about the same thing, because they didn't even talk about they were talking about the same people, but different things. And when you went to the bibliography at the back, you could find out why. The Christian one that presented the persuasion that we would kind of agree with, all of his sources were pre-1900. All the books he read to get his information were pre. The other one was all post-2000. Every book he referenced, and I think outside of one from the 1970s, every book he referenced was written after 2000. We've had a rewriting of history. You've got to go back. And so what Isaac Backus wrote is wonderful information. He was a prolific writer. He also wrote all kinds of treatises, sermons, attacks on false doctrines, different things, Isaac Backus. His record of the persecutions faced by the early American Baptists are a great testimony to the perseverance of the faithful. As we mentioned a month or so ago in studying that previous time period, Fox's Book of Martyrs, written by John Fox, about all the persecutions of believers back then, Isaac Backus recorded all those things in continental America, of the oppression of Baptists by the powers that be. So Isaac Backus. Number three, John Ganoe. He's one of my favorites. Did I say that already? All right, John Ganoe. John Ganoe was born July 22nd, 1727 in Hopewell, New Jersey, and was converted at an early age. Though his maternal grandmother and his mother were Baptists, his father was a Presbyterian. After much study and counsel, including with the Presbyterian minister, concerning infant baptism, all right, again, that was the thing, and with his father's permission, he was baptized by immersion and joined the Baptist Church in Hopewell. All right, John Ganoe. He was pastor of the Scotch Plains Baptist Church in New Jersey, and I will not read the years. He was the pastor of Jersey Baptist in North Carolina, First Baptist in New York City. We'll get back to that in a minute. Town Fork Baptist Church in Kentucky. All right, those dates, 1762 to 1787, when he was at the First Baptist Church in New York. In 1776, while he was pastoring there, he was also the chaplain, a chaplain in the Revolutionary War. From 1776 to 1783, when the war ended, he was a chaplain. In fact, George Washington, at the end of the war in 1783, when they had the great ceremony closing it, John Gonneau is the one that George Washington asked to pray at the closing of the Revolutionary War. Their friendship went farther than that because on April 19, 1783, John Gonneau baptized George Washington in the Potomac River. His son Stephen was pastor of the church founded by Roger Williams, who we talked about last week, in Providence, Rhode Island from 1792 to 1828. John Gonneau is the one that baptized George Washington in the Potomac. This, again, is a subject of great debate. You'll not hear this taught even in history classes anymore. In fact, they will reject this. They will deny this. They will attack this. They will criticize this. They will say it didn't happen, that it was a rumor that was started. Well, let me read you an article from Time Magazine. Time Magazine from September 5th, 1932. Now, I'll be honest. I don't have that magazine. I wish I did. That'd be worth some money. But again, this is online. You can go and research that. And this is from, I've got it printed out, the Time Magazine on Washington's baptism. And here's what it says. George Washington one day went to Reverend John Gonneau, chaplain of the Continental Army, and exclaimed, "I have been investigating the Scripture, and I believe immersion to be the baptism taught in the Word of God, and I demand it at your hands. I do not wish any parade made or the army called out, but simply a quiet demonstration of the ordinance." In the presence of 42 witnesses, George Washington was immersed in the Potomac by John Gonneau. All right, so that's one of our spiritual ancestors that baptized George Washington in the Potomac River. All right, back to the other side of the page. Here we have Samuel Harris, Colonel Samuel Harris. He was born on January 12th in 1724 in Hanover County, Virginia. He held many high-ranking offices. All right, he was a justice of the peace. He was a sheriff. He was even the head of a church, though he didn't go to church and was unconverted. But he also was a colonel in the militia during the Revolutionary War. It wasn't until he was 34 years old that his conversion to Christ took place. Two brothers, William and Joseph Murphy, who had been converted and baptized under the ministry of Shubal Stearns. All right, see how that works? Shubal Stearns had gotten the Murphy brothers converted. The Murphy brothers are going to get Samuel Harris converted. Samuel Harris is going to get James Ireland converted. It's just snowballs down through our history. That's the way things are supposed to work. All right? They were holding a Baptist meeting nearby. Harris was riding up on his horse in full military dress, and he asked, "What is to be done here, gentlemen?" as they were all gathering for an outdoor church service. "What is to be done here?" Someone answered, "Preaching, Colonel." "Who is to preach?" "The Murphy boys, sir." They had a reputation and were known. He said, "I believe I will stop and hear them." It is said, and again, I'm giving synopsises here. It's said that when he heard Joseph Murphy preach, he got under such conviction that when he got up and left the meeting, he left his hat and his sword and his belt on the chair when he went out. Can you imagine a colonel leaving his sword there? He was under such conviction. And he went out there, and the story that I read is he went out into the woods, and he got under such conviction that he got down by the tree and asked God to forgive his sins and save his soul. Following this, he was baptized by Daniel Marshall. Daniel Marshall is the brother-in-law of Shubal Stearns, one of the 16 that went down to North Carolina. Again, that Sandy Creek Association had such a powerful effect on the colonies. Although he immediately began preaching with great effect throughout Virginia and North Carolina, he was not ordained a Baptist preacher until October 11, 1769, at the Sandy Creek Meeting House. Back then, a pastor could not baptize anyone or give the Lord's Supper unless he was ordained. So Samuel Harris could preach as much as he wanted to as an unordained minister, but he couldn't do the ordinances of the church. So when he got ordained in 1769, then he was able to do that, and he got ordained at the Sandy Creek Meeting House. In his preaching, he was favorably compared to George Whitefield and baptized hundreds of converts during his ministry, including James Ireland. That's a name you can look up on Google and see who James Ireland was, a Baptist preacher back in that day that suffered many things because of his faith. He gave all his former wealth to the cause of the gospel and was threatened, assaulted, and even jailed in 1768 for the Lord. Samuel Harris did not face the opposition that others did because of his position as a colonel. He had been so highly regarded that people just kind of left him alone a little bit, but it only went so far. And even he faced some of that persecution. He sold everything he owned. He had, as a colonel, he had his house, and when he got converted, he was in the process of building a big mansion. And after he got saved, he got convicted about spending all that money on a big mansion, and so he stayed at his small house, and that big house he finished and made it the church house, where everybody could meet there. He gave everything he had to the Lord. Samuel Harris. And then lastly tonight, John Waller. He's one of my favorites. They called him Swearing Jack. That's not why he's my favorite, because they call him Swearing Jack. But this was a rough guy. He was born in Spotsylvania County, Virginia on December 23rd, 1741. His intention was to study law, but the financial support was from an uncle who died prematurely. Again, if you read more about this fella, he was very intelligent, very smart. That's why he was going to school for law. But when his uncle died, who was paying his way through school, he could not go any longer because his parents did not have the money. And so the effort he put into school, he put into living a wicked life. He was a gambler. He was a drunkard. He was a fighter. He was a troublemaker. And everybody knew him. This led to a life of sinfulness, that's what we're talking about, and profanity to such an extent that he was identified as Swearing Jack Waller. He was called upon for the grand jury. I don't know how they do that. Remember JFK, John F. Kennedy, is always called Jack. John Westover, anybody have called you Jack? All right, I don't know why Johns are Jack, but that's his name was John, but they called him Swearing Jack Waller. They did that. I don't know why. He was called upon for the grand jury in the trial of a Baptist preacher, Lewis Craig, for unlawful preaching. Waller was an anti-Baptist. He believed they were troublemakers. Can you imagine a guy that's a crook and a thief and a drunk and a fighter and a gambler, and he thought the Baptists were bad guys? And so he sat in on the grand jury of Lewis Craig, who was being tried for unlawful preaching. He didn't have a license from the Congregational Church, which eventually led to his conversion. Craig had been, much like Waller, Craig had been a bad guy, a troublemaker. And he said at his trial, when Waller was there, he said, "All the years that I lived in sin and fought and drank and cussed, nobody ever gave me any problems. Now I'm living right and clean and preaching the gospel, and you're bringing me in before a grand jury." And his words to Waller just stuck to him so hard, because that was his life at the time, that's what led to his conviction and his conversion. He was baptized by immersion in 1767 and started a Baptist congregation in his hometown, of which he was ordained its pastor in June 20th, 1770. He preached everywhere an opportunity presented itself. He went down to Massachusetts. He went into Virginia. He went many places due to the intolerance of the established church. During this time of his ministry, he spent a combined 113 days in four different jails. One time was 45 days in one jail. And when he was jailed, he was not just thrown in a cell. He was deprived of food. He was beaten and whipped and all these kind of things. One time he and three other men were at a place, and they were standing up on a table preaching. And when Waller got up on the table to preach, some of the ruffians from that area, some of his former friends and colleagues that didn't like his conversion, came and forcibly yanked him down off that table, pulling him by his hair and his coat and everything else, and hailing him to constable to be thrown into jail. Under his ministry in Virginia, he baptized more than 2,000 persons, assisted in the ordination of 27 ministers, and had part in the establishing of 18 churches. His son Absalom who was saved at age 19 and ordained at 21, succeeded him as pastor and himself baptized more than 1,500 persons. John Waller died on July 4th, 1802, at the age of 60. The reason we look at these is to understand our heritage. Understand where we've come. Understand that people paid a price for the freedom we have, spiritually speaking. We are thankful for Jefferson, Washington, all those guys. We're thankful for all those that give us the liberty we have in America. But we're even more thankful for those that fought and paid the price. I don't know that folks are willing to do that today. How many folks would be willing to have their goods confiscated for preaching without a license from the state if the state decided to go that direction? How many, if they made an established church that had infant baptism, would be so opposed to it that they would face these trials and tribulations? Not many folks. We live in too easy and comfortable days. But these are men at that time and their families that paid a price. One of these preachers, I forget which one, he sacrificed so much that he went out, and I'm not saying this was the right thing to do, but he went out and preached and had such a burden to preach and get people converted that he left his wife and his kids back in the farmland while he went out and spent all his time preaching, and the farmhouse deteriorated and the crops weren't being harvested and picked, and the family was going out things because he was dedicating himself to the gospel of Christ. Now, I don't necessarily recommend that kind of lifestyle, but that's the burden they had back then. And we've come a long way, baby. That's what one of the expressions is. We're not like it used to be. One other note, and I didn't have this. Which one was it? It was John Ganot. If you study John Ganot's family line down through the line, Howard Hughes is a descendant of John Ganot. All right? Through his mother, through his mother's line. There were some well-known names that came from John Ganot down through the line. They had a picture painted of him baptizing George Washington in the Potomac River that stood in one of the universities for a number of years, and now is at Smithsonian or something like that. So these are fellows that laid the groundwork for us to have the freedom we have today. Next week will be our last lesson in these. We'll see two more American Baptists and then two noteworthy great English Baptists. And that will pretty much bring us up to date. We're not doing 20th century guys, but we're just coming up that far. All right, let's all stand together this evening. We will just, Brother Gary, we'll just have a word of prayer here tonight in closing.